Welcome to the Principal Source audio presentation of What Are Our Spiritual Needs by Dr. Nathaniel Brandon. This lecture was delivered at the Objectivist Center's 1999 fall conference entitled What Should We Worship? Reclaiming Spirituality from Religion, which examined this idea from a number of perspectives.
Our next speaker is world-renowned for his work in psychology. He is a practicing psychotherapist, a prolific author. He has developed on the basis of his wide range of knowledge in philosophy and psychology, psychological theories that are changed in many ways his field. In particular, he is known as the father of the self-esteem movement and the self-esteem concept, having brought that back into the understanding of personality and motivation and human well-being. Nathaniel Brandon began the Objectivist movement as well, working with Ayn Rand in the 1960s, taught the first courses on Objectivism, both the philosophy and psychology, among other topics. He's the author, I believe it was his first book, of The Psychology of Self-Esteem, which over the years has sold more than 1 million copies, a remarkable record for a work of psychological theory. More recently, he has formulated his theory of self-esteem in the six pillars of self-esteem. Other recent books of his include Taking Responsibility and The Art of Living Consciously, which is a book of particular significance for our topic and our interest today. And I highly recommend that the entire book as an expansion or a source of insight into what we're talking about today. In particular, in the final chapter, Nathaniel addressed the issue of spirituality and mysticism and drew what seems to me a very clear and effective line between them, and on that basis did yeoman's service of rescuing spirituality as a concept from mysticism. We're very fortunate that today he has come to enlarge for us on that theme and approach by talking more specifically about spiritual needs. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome someone I know most of you know and admire as much as I do, Nathaniel Brandon, to speak on What Are Spiritual Needs?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. When I gave my first lecture on Objectivism in New York City in the winter and spring of 1958, it was my great good fortune to know everything. There was no subject about which I didn't have an opinion and an instant answer and very little doubt about my infallibility. So that if at that time you had asked me, and I guess I'd have to say, or if you'd asked Diane, what is spirituality and what is its role in human life, either one of us would have told you in two or three succinct sentences, spirituality is such and such, its role is such and such, next. 40 years later, I'm a little slower on the draw. I find that in the third act of my life, I am increasingly interested in the whole issue of what is spirituality and what are our spiritual needs. And I want to share with you some reflections today and some preliminary observations of what I very much regard as a work in progress inside my own mind. So that if I were asked to give a similar talk by David a year from now, I'd probably be saying not contradictory things, but perhaps some additional things that will occur to me to say to you this afternoon. You don't find many references to spirit or spirituality in Rand's work, and yet there are respects in which her work is very spiritual, and I want to make a few preliminary observations about that. I don't know if you have read the journals of Ayn Rand and you've read her notes for the character of Rourke or Galt, but if you read them, or for that matter, if you look at the characterizations of the two men themselves, I don't think you can help but be struck by the fact that they are, by anybody's definition I know of, very profoundly spiritual beings. Meaning what? Meaning that they are operating out of a very, very high level of consciousness. They are operating out of a level of consciousness that allows them to keep their internal center and balance in the face of very difficult vicissitudes and adversities in the real world. They don't get hysterical. They are not reactive personalities. They manage to sustain a deeply serene base under very, very difficult and challenging circumstances, such as very few human beings are able to do. And one of the things that I remember thinking when I reread Ian's notes for Rourke and Galt about a year ago was how Zen-like Rourke and Galt are in certain respects, in that highly developed witness consciousness, in that certain kind of psychological distance that they are able to preserve from events, that they don't become swallowed up by them, overwhelmed by them, or react in ways that will shame or embarrass them later to remember. And, of course, in the context of the book, one of the commonest complaints from readers is that the author gives us no indication of how one ever arrives at such a state of consciousness as Rourke and Galt exemplify. In fact, in the journal, Ian suggests that Rourke was born that way. Not very likely. And certainly not very helpful. But what is interesting is that it's a challenge to philosophers and psychologists to think through, well, if these are admirable states, what would it take or to evolve to this state of consciousness? And I'll say a little more about that later. I remember further talking with Ian, and I might have mentioned this, I forget, in my memoir, about that one of the things that I loved about Atlas and that I knew was going to drive the opposition crazy was the way in which she spiritualized secular reality. That she took an aspect of reality, material production, sex, and other activities that are clearly, in some sense, pertaining to the material domain, and kind of turned them upside down from conventional thinking and imbued them with a very, very deep spiritual significance. And I think one feels that even if one doesn't use any of the words that I'm using in this talk. I think that at some level one gets that, and that's part of what allows one to be reached by the stories at a very, very deep soul level, the feeling that one has been transported into some other realm where it's a complete reversal of ordinary values, but it's a reversal of the most exhilarating kind. Finally, I remember something that Frank O'Connor said after he read the torture scene at the climax of Atlas Shrugged. I happened to be there when he was when he was reading it in Ian's handwriting. And this was the, you might remember the scene where Galt is being tortured at the end of the book. And Galt, and Frank said to Ian, "This is the most spiritual scene you have ever written." And we knew immediately what he meant. Because what he meant was, again, the triumph of a very highly evolved consciousness in circumstances that would test the strongest of persons, and the ability of the man to remain himself and to retain a particular perspective under impossibly painful and difficult circumstances. So that is clearly a manifestation of the triumph of very high levels of consciousness. Now, As David kindly said in his introduction, my first real discussion of spirituality and my extricating of spirituality from religion and mysticism is in my book, The Art of Living Consciously, wherein I take considerable pains to separate spirituality from doctrines of self-transcendence or an ethics of selflessness or mysticism in general. But it's interesting to think for a few minutes. Allow me to just talk about spirit and spirituality in general for a few minutes before we get into our spiritual needs. Don't tell David this presentation is going to take about 4 hours. The word spirit in its origins means breath. Spirit pertains to the breath of life. When Aristotle spoke about spirit or soul, he meant that by virtue of which an organism is alive. And to this day, when we speak of a person or a horse as high-spirited, we mean what? Full of life. Or when we speak of a person's spirit being broken, we mean what? We mean the person's will to live self-assertively has been extinguished. The life force has been subdued. So in this understanding, spiritual would mean pertaining to the life force or the life principle. However, this is not the primary meaning the term has for us today, although you might be interested to know that it is a meaning that you'll find in many, if not most, dictionaries, pertaining to the life force or the life principle. Centuries ago, however, the focus shifted from life to consciousness or soul as a central component of spirituality, so that spirit came to be denoted as something closer to the life force or the life principle as manifest in consciousness. And that is pretty much how I think of the term today. And spirituality is best understood as meaning pertaining to consciousness and to the needs and development of consciousness. The connection to the earlier meaning lies in the fact that consciousness is usually understood to be an attribute of life at a certain level of organization. So there we get the linkage back to life. One advantage of this definition, namely consciousness pertaining as meaning spirituality as pertaining to consciousness and the needs of development of consciousness, well, the advantage of this definition is that it's neutral. It doesn't commit one to any specific position concerning what a spiritual life might consist of, nor does it commit one to any particular religious belief. Further, we might notice that we usually mean spiritual to be contrasted with material and materialistic. So if spiritual means pertaining to consciousness, then material means pertaining to or constituted of matter. And that is probably the general sense in which philosophers today would speak about spiritual. And it's certainly the terms in which I will be thinking about it and talking about it today, at least preliminarily. The only modification I would make is that if you notice how we use it, we usually mean not only pertaining to consciousness, but consciousness in its higher levels of development. We don't usually use it in connection with, for example, sense perception experiences, even though that's an aspect of consciousness. But when we talk about pertaining to consciousness in the context of talking about spirituality, I think whoever uses it, almost it's obvious from the context, is talking about consciousness in its higher manifestations and higher levels of development. Let me say preliminarily then that if spirituality means pertaining to consciousness and the needs and development of consciousness, then whoever commits to awareness and personal growth as a way of life, which entails, among other things, self-awareness and self-examination, is on a spiritual path. Whoever continually strives to achieve a cleaner and a clearer vision of reality and his or her place in it, whoever is pulled forward by a passion for such clarity, is, to that extent, leading a spiritual life, as I understand the terms. When I wrote The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, I was aware at the time that I was presenting a spiritual discipline, even though I did not name it as such. To train oneself in the six pillars as a consistent practice, to seek to integrate them into one's daily life and activities so that they become a way of being, is to be dedicated to spiritual development. My reason for not naming this issue explicitly in that book was because I wanted the book to be perceived as a book of psychology primarily and secondarily a philosophy. It's really, of course, a book about values. All my books are really books about values, disguised as books about one subject or another, usually psychology. I remember many years ago when this was first brought to my attention, a former psychotherapy client of mine, a successful screenwriter, took me to lunch, and this was 1980, and The Psychology of Romantic Love had just come out. And he said, you know, this is such a deceptive book. And I was quite surprised. I said, what do you mean deceptive? He said, well, on the face of it, it's a book about man-woman relationships. But if you go one step deeper, it's a book about values and ethics. And I was stunned because I realized he was absolutely right. And that was quite unconscious on my part at the time, but not since. Now, a few more words about... I'll come back to the subject of the six pillars in spirituality because it's relevant to the whole subject of our spiritual needs. But I want to say just one or two things about spirituality and religion, because it's often observed that spirituality is primarily the domain of direct personal experience, of a person's direct relation with reality. Spirituality pertains to experience. Religion, at least in its commoner definitions, is primarily the domain of beliefs, rules, and rituals. Authentic spirituality is reflected in how one lives and how one experiences existence, not in what one professes to believe. And in this sense, it is intrinsically individualistic rather than conformist. A person may use, and this should be acknowledged, a person may use his or her religion to inspire a personal spiritual journey, a quest for greater consciousness, but religion itself does not necessarily imply any such quest, and indeed it may support the illusion of spirituality while leading in the opposite direction by demanding that consciousness be sacrificed to faith and threatening hell as punishment for thinking, or by ridiculing a person's struggle to make sense out of what is being taught. So, about any tenet, irrespective of where it comes from, religion or otherwise, it's always important to ask, does this support or constrict the active use of my mind? Is this teaching addressed to my understanding or to my fears? Am I being offered awareness or escape from the responsibility of awareness? The courage to raise and confront such questions is itself a spiritual achievement, its consciousness committed to its own growth and self-actualization. On the subject of religion, one last thought, because it allows me to make a little segue to objectivism. It's easy enough to believe that if one goes to church on Sunday, listens to a sermon, and sings a few hymns, one's life has a spiritual center. However, such a practice may be the opposite of what we imagine it to be. It may arrest the mind in complacent contemplation of the comfortably accepted, the beliefs with which one was raised. Spirit, in contrast, is a summons to rise, to shatter and transcend the boundaries of the familiar. Spirit, in the sense that I'm talking about it here. Now, the relevance of that is to us is that it's very easy to come at objectivism from the perspective of a spiritual experience or a religion. And it's very, very easy, and we all know that there are many people who would call themselves objectivists, but who have converted it into a religion, because it becomes a set of beliefs, a set of rituals, a set of saying the appropriate things in appropriate contexts, with no serious space for individual awareness, individual experience, individual judgment. There's quite a well-known temple to objectivist religion in Los Angeles, actually. It's called ARI. Now, we are living in a time when more and more people are groping and looking for something they call spirituality. And as is understandable, they don't know quite where to look, and they look in some very unfortunate places, characterized by a good deal of, when not falsehood, then superficiality. But the quest shouldn't be ridiculed. The hunger that the quest entails or implies shouldn't be ridiculed. It's easy enough to make fun of some of the forms in which people profess to find spiritual meaning or spiritual significance. But even the most absurd of those forms respond in some way to what is ultimately a legitimate human need. And I want to talk about it shortly, what I think some of those legitimate human needs are. One of the evidences of the growing concern with consciousness, however understood, of spirituality, however understood, one of the most interesting manifestations is that more and more Westerners are exploring the practice of meditation and are discovering that meditation does indeed, for many, have multiple benefits as a potential path to self-understanding or enhanced creativity or a deeper appreciation of what is important in life or a clearer grasp of one's own mental processes or a deeper perception of reality or the experience of greater serenity. Many people have found meditation a very useful vehicle for the attaining of genuine and real values. All this is quite apart from the issue of whether or not one subscribes to the religious or philosophical presuppositions of any particular meditative practice. Many enthusiastic meditators have little or no interest in religion or mysticism, and there is certainly nothing intrinsically, quote, mystical, unquote, about meditation per se. I am personally convinced that it's a profoundly useful practice on many levels. Needless to say, the results of meditation vary enormously from person to person. For one person, meditation is a helpful means to enhance relaxation. For another, an invaluable tool of self-understanding. For another, a source of spiritual transformation and growth. And there are many reasons why different people will have different outcomes, but my point only is that we don't want to dismiss without question practices just because historically they may have arisen in a religious context. One example of that is that it might help to bring that issue into greater clarity, is that some of the most important work done in evolving our present understanding of natural rights was done by Catholic theologians in the Middle Ages. In fact, Tom Palmer of the Cato Institute tells me that one or more theologians in the Middle Ages mounted a defense of natural rights which eerily comes almost unbelievably close in its anticipation to Rand's derivation of natural rights. But we don't want to dismiss it because perhaps it was first enunciated by somebody working in a monastery. Rather, we look at the idea and we say, does it have merit? We do reality testing. We check it against reason, reality observation. Does it make sense? We don't say, I'm not interested since its source is a Christian monastery or a Buddhist monk or whatever. And we don't want to be reactive, like reflexively saying, well, every good objectivist knows nothing good could come. You know, something good comes from the most strange places. I'll tell you something that I learned very early in life. It's impossible to talk for longer than a minute without saying something true. Think about that. I think that one of the meanings of growing in consciousness and learning is what can I learn from the people I disagree with? What can I learn from people whose orientation is very different from my own? What in all that mountain of what I don't like, are there any relevant truths for me to learn? I think that's one of the great spiritual challenges right there that has to do with our growth and development. Now, very fast, I assume some of you know what the six pillars are, but I'm going to name them very, very fast, but look at them now from the aspect of spirituality. Everything that I write about in the six pillars has to do with one idea, and that is improving the quality of the relationship between consciousness and reality. everything that spirituality is ultimately about is growing in the quality of the relationship between consciousness and reality. Everything that Rand wrote about ultimately can be understood in that context, though that's not how she framed it. Working on the quality of the relationship between consciousness and reality is what the six pillars is all about. What's the first of the six pillars? The practice of living consciously. Let me very briefly integrate it with as a need to spirituality. If the foundation of the practice of living consciously is, of course, respect for the facts of reality, respect for truth, recognition of that which is. Such a practice reflects the understanding that to place consciousness in an adversarial relationship to existence, to evade or dismiss reality, is to invite trouble, ultimately to invite destruction. To work at cultivating such awareness within oneself, this practice of living consciously, is a noble pursuit, even a heroic one, because truth is sometimes frightening or painful, and the temptation to close one's eyes is sometimes very strong. Whether the awareness we need to expand pertains to the external world or the world within ourselves, to strive for greater clarity of perception and understanding, to move always in the direction of heightened mindfulness, to revere the truth above the avoidance of fear or pain, is to commit ourselves to spiritual growth, the continuing development of our ability to see. Whatever other virtue we may aspire to, this one is the base, cultivating our ability to see. And ultimately, if spirituality is about anything, it's about cultivating our ability to see. The second pillar is the practice of self-acceptance. The practice of self-acceptance is the application of living consciously specifically to oneself, because self-acceptance means realism, respect for reality, but now concerning ourselves. It's the acceptance of our thoughts, emotions, and behavior, not necessarily in the sense of liking, condoning, or admiring, but in the sense of not denying or disowning. Self-acceptance is my willingness to stand in the presence of my thoughts, feelings, and actions with an attitude that makes approval or disapproval irrelevant, namely, the desire to be aware. Obviously, we will like and enjoy some aspects of who we are far more than others. That's not the point. What is at issue is whether we can be open to that which we may not like or enjoy. Perhaps I've had some embarrassing thoughts that reflect an envy or a jealousy I believed I was above. Perhaps I sometimes experience emotions that clash with my official self-concept, such as hurt or humiliation or rage. Perhaps I have sometimes acted in ways that are shocking and dismaying to recall. The question is always, can I allow space within my awareness for such realities without retreating into rationalization, denial, alibiing, or some other form of avoidance, and also without collapsing into self-repudiation? Spiritual growth cannot be made out of self-made blindness. The more aspects of reality a consciousness is open to seeing, and the operative word here is seeing, not groundless believing, the more highly evolved the consciousness, and therefore the more mature the level of spiritual development. The third pillar is the practice of self-responsibility. In understanding the practice of self-responsibility, we'll begin with the observation that the natural development of a human being is from dependence to independence, from helplessness to increasing efficacy. So self-responsibility means that we recognize, first, that we are the author of our choices and actions, and second, that we are responsible for our life and well-being and for the attainment of our desires, and third, that if we wish to gain values from others, we must offer values in exchange. The most fundamental expression of self-responsibility is, of course, reliance on our minds, the choice to think and to operate consciously, as contrasted with living second-hand off the borrowed values and judgments of others. Independence in the full sense is not a state that comes easily to most people. What many people call thinking is merely recycling of the thoughts and opinions of other people. To look at the world through one's own eyes and be willing to live by one's own judgment requires courage, self-trust, and intellectual conscientiousness. To be willing to be accountable for one's actions requires integrity. These are moral and spiritual values, if anything is, and they are profound moral and spiritual needs if the goal is to lead a fulfilling life. Now, the fourth pillar, self-assertiveness, the practice of self-assertiveness, is an interesting one because to the conventional mind, self-assertiveness may seem like the very opposite of a spiritual value. And yet, if the practice of self-assertiveness is considered not in a vacuum, torn from all context, but as part of a network of virtues that include honesty, rationality, self-responsibility, and integrity, then self-assertiveness may be viewed in a very different light as an essential step toward the realization of our humanity. Self-assertiveness is not about running over widows and orphans to get to the front of the line, or about being rude to waiters, or behaving as though no one's needs existed but one's own. When I talk about self-assertiveness, I have in mind the courage to treat oneself and one's convictions with decent respect in encounters with other people, the willingness to stand up for one's ideas and to live one's values in the real world, the honesty to let oneself be visible to others, or to say it differently, not to be so controlled by fear of someone's disapproval that we twist our true self out of recognizable form. Thus defined, we can see that self-assertiveness is not self-indulgence, but is among the rarest of virtues. Certainly, spirituality is more to be associated with openness than with self-concealment, with candor rather than with dissembling, and with authenticity rather than with a calculated persona. The fifth pillar is that of living purposefully. The practice of living purposefully, as opposed to passively drifting through life, is essential to any genuine sense of control over one's existence. To live purposely means what? It means to think through and formulate our short-term and our long-term goals and purposes, to identify the actions we need to realize them, to keep oneself on track, and to pay careful attention to whether the outcomes produced by our actions are those we intended. Otherwise, back to the drawing board. To act only on the whim of the moment or on the basis of the chance encounter or chance invitation or chance opportunity as one's fundamental response, then what? One is not a thoughtful initiator, but only an impulsive reactor. To remove oneself from the realm of purpose, here is the point, is to exist on the sidelines of life, to become a non-participant in life. After that, no form of spirituality is possible. Finally, the practice of integrity entails what? Congruence between what we know, what we profess, and what we do. To be loyal in action to one's understanding and professed convictions is therefore the essence of integrity. When there is not congruence but contradiction, at some level consciousness is betraying itself. If one is genuinely concerned, therefore, folks, with the growth and evolution of consciousness, which is what a spiritual quest or commitment entails, then a lack of integrity is not to be tolerated. It is a self-inflicted wound one must try to heal. If we torment our mate with small or large lies and inconsistencies, are cruel to our children, or dishonorable with our associates, colleagues, or customers, if we run from honest self-examination while protesting it is our highest concern, we cannot buy our way into spirituality by studying the I Ching, the Kabbalah, the Bible, or the scriptures of Buddhism, or by reading Atlas Shrugged. The issue is not so much whether we are perfect in our integrity, but rather how concerned we are to correct such breaches as might exist. In the absence of such concern, whatever our life journey is about, it's not about spiritual growth. So I hope I make clear why I regard the six practices as also reflecting spiritual needs, by which I mean practices that in their absence thwart and sabotage the evolution and development of consciousness. And that by that criteria, they are bona fide needs. Let us move on to some other needs. For many people, one of the commonest associations with the idea of spirituality, and by the way, it's real interesting to just ask people casually, what does the word spirituality connote to you? Chances are you'll get as many different answers as people will respond to your question, but it's an educational question to ask. For many people, one of the commonest associations with the idea of spirituality is the longing to feel at home in the universe, to feel benevolently connected to all that exists and to the ultimate source, whatever that might be, of all that exists. I'm not, in this context, going to raise the troublesome question of whether we wish to be benevolently connected to that which we regard as evil. Instead, we'll focus just on the longing for the experience of peace and harmony with existence in the most profound sense imaginable, because this is certainly what people are central to what people are looking at, irrespective of which spiritual path they go down, irrespective of what religious path they go down, irrespective of what mystical path they go down. If they're looking for anything, one of the most saliently obvious things they are looking for is some experience of harmony or peace or connectedness with the universe. And that is a deep spiritual need in all of us. I think the evidence for this historically, anthropologically, sociologically, is so enormous that I can't believe it needs to be argued about. The fact that we do not, it's not a happy state to feel hanging out in a universe where one is, in the most profound metaphysical sense, an alienated stranger. One wants the sense of a home that is in some sense safe, secure, intelligible, and I do believe that this is the one of the promises of religion and of mystical spiritual teachings which attracts people to it. Now, God is only one particular manifestation, let me say as an aside of this issue. Not all religions even entail a belief in God. You may or may not appreciate that fact. Buddhism, which is one of the great spiritual religions of the world, has no reference to a god in it. The Japanese central religion doesn't have a god in any sense comparable to the Western sense. But they all have a vision which places you, allows you the dream, the hope, to come home to ultimate reality. And for those of us who are non-believers, those of us who are atheists, those of us who are rationalists, we seek that experience in part through a rational philosophy which will allow us to have the experience of, in some sense, understanding the universe in which we live, in some sense, understanding our place in the universe in which we live, and in some sense, having a vision of that place as positive or benevolent. And that is certainly the vision that Atlas offers. Those who relate to that vision, relate to that way of seeing the world. And I don't know of any more basic spiritual need, and one that requires a lot of thinking about, because many people, or most people, exist in a state of alienation so habitual, so long-lived, that one loses the ability to recognize it or to know that it's alienation. But I do think that we'll never understand the appeal of mass movements, of religions, of spiritual traditions of every kind, if we don't understand that deep soul longing to feel at home and in some sense to find our way home, which is what many people over the years have told me was the experience they felt when they read Atlas Shrugged, that they had come home. So we may not admire some of what people choose to call home, but we don't want to mock that longing to come home. Harmony with the universe presupposes a non-adversarial relationship to self and the non-adversarial relationship to reality. If I'm engaged in emotional repression, self-repudiation, self-rejection, self-denial, self-disowning, constantly slicing off pieces of my soul in order to fit some concept of who I'm supposed to be, or to avoid pain or fear, no way can my soul or mind or any other part of me feel at peace. No part of me can feel benevolently related to the universe. And on the other hand, if I keep shutting my eyes at different external realities, which for one reason or another I don't want to look at, see, absorb, integrate, or think about, again, I place myself in an adversarial relationship with external reality, and again, in that condition, I am necessarily a stranger and afraid in a cosmos I never made. So, again, we're led back to rationality, we're led back to acceptance, we're led back to realism, we're led back to consciousness, we're led back to respect for facts as the foundation of all spiritual growth and all spiritual harmony. We have a need and a desire for connectedness with nature. That's one aspect of the universe. And many of us know what a profound experience that can sometimes be to be out in the woods or on top of a mountain or somewhere alone or with some special companion and to experience a different sense of one's relationship to the physical world of nature around one that can be quite intoxicating, that can be quite invigorating. And you know, the mere fact that we have such an experience doesn't mean that we will necessarily find the best words with which to describe it or communicate it to others. In one of the talks this morning, I believe Emerson was quoted, and perhaps we smiled at the way that he spoke about what his experience was with nature. But then you have to ask yourself, what was the man trying to say? What was the experience, perhaps deeper than the way that he elected to say it? So we have this, I believe, need and desire to feel connected with nature and to feel ourselves as part of the natural world, not as metaphysical freaks. There's a great deal which encourages us to feel like metaphysical freaks, but I think that's a story for another day, what in our culture encourages that. We need also a sense of connectedness with other people. We are social beings. We do need other human beings for the achievement of our own distinctively human potentialities. Now, many of us have painful experiences early in life which cause us to shut down emotionally to such extent that all of our relationships with other people take place at a great psychological distance between us and them. And that's a tragedy. Because one of our psychological needs, one of our emotional needs, and one of our spiritual needs is for human companions to whom we can relate up close, with whom we can share some of the experiences of life, with whom we can exercise our ability to love. And so, and I know that some of the more orthodox objectivists may have difficulty with this one, although I know that Rand would not disagree with me. Our need for that connectedness with other people is a spiritual need. Anything Howard Roark may have said to the contrary, notwithstanding. Now, as soon as we begin to think about our need for other people, we immediately plug into certain other needs, which I am convinced are spiritual needs and demonstrably spiritual needs, of which I'll just name a few very quickly. I believe that we have a profound spiritual need to find persons or things in the world that will allow us to experience the emotion of admiration. And I think that in the absence of that experience, our soul feels starved. I believe that we need to find persons and objects in whom we can see some sort of meaningful and significant value. And that when we can't, whether we are conscious of it or not, it's very painful. I believe that one of our spiritual needs, too seldom recognized, is to cultivate within ourselves the ability to love. Now, that may be puzzling because one might think, well, can't everybody love? And I would have to answer yes and no. I would have to say that based upon working with people for 40 years and having been allowed to become intimately knowledgeable about the conditions of a lot of human beings, I would say that quite a large number of people, in the sense I mean, don't know how to love. They know how to have an emotion, which they will call love, but not to love if you think of love as an action versus if you think of love as an emotion. If you think of love as an action, which means caring, concern, empathy, respect, compassion, kindness, reliability, the ability to give another person the experience of visibility, I don't think the average person is that very good at that. They want to be on the receiving end of it. But I don't think the average person is very good at giving it. In an earlier book of mine called Taking Responsibility, I will be forever grateful to my editor because after the book was finished, it was short, one chapter, which is now in the book, which bears on this issue. I dealt with self-responsibility in general, and I dealt with a chapter on what self-responsibility means in the context of business. And my editor phones me up, and she says, Nathaniel, there's a big missing piece in this book. You have this chapter on self-responsibility in the workplace. Now write a corresponding chapter on what self-responsibility means in the context of marriage and romantic love. And I did, and I guess that's my favorite chapter in the book now. Because it gave me a chance to spell out that which is not obvious about what it means to know how to love and how much more it means than just being able to have an emotion for a while. There's a reason why some people are able to sustain in an active sense the emotion of love over decades, and for others the fire goes out very quickly. And that has got everything to do with the depth of one's understanding of how to love. That's a subject for another day. Maybe it would make a good presentation at some future seminar, but it's not something I can get into at the moment beyond these brief observations of saying it is a spiritual need. Now, coming to the end of my talk, I was just joking about 4 hours. That was just what I would like to have that much time. I didn't really plan to take it. The one spiritual need that Ayn wrote about was art. And she wrote about art, you might remember, in the Romantic Manifesto and the essays that first appeared in The Objectivist. And that was the one time that I can recall where she talked in some depth about a need of consciousness, which clearly was we would understand by a spiritual need. And she talked about art in that context as giving human beings an opportunity to experience at a perceptual level their broadest and deepest sense of life abstractions. She said, through art, we can take these immense sense of life abstractions and we can concretize them so that we can experience them perceptually. And since perceptual experience is the ultimate form of experiencing reality, this is a great gift to the human consciousness to be able to bring these immense abstractions down to that level of specific gestures, actions, and words. And I agree with all of that, only I believe that I would add something else to her analysis. I would say I agree with everything. And after I agree with everything you have said, I would add this. I believe that we have a need, separate from what I've just said, for an expanded and exalted and exhilarated state of consciousness such as art at its best can evoke in us. If any of you remember, as I can remember very clearly, like the first time you read The Fountainhead or the first time you read Atlas Shrugged, and the kind of unique, unparalleled excitement that you felt, and the sense of being totally flipped out of ordinary reality, flipped out of ordinary everyday state of consciousness into some totally other outer space. How many of you know what I'm talking about experientially? Okay. Good. I believe that that need for what I will call the need for an ecstatic state of consciousness is a separate and distinguishable spiritual need. It's not an accident that in every culture that we have ever known, no exceptions, anthropologists tell us, you've always found drugs or ceremonies or rituals of which the intention was to take people into another state of consciousness, an ecstatic state of consciousness different from ordinary perception, different from the ordinary experience of reality. Because, let's face it, the ordinary reality that we live in, what happens is through sheer familiarity, it gets stale. You know, we cease to see reality afresh, and we can't help ourselves to some extent because the psychologists who study perception tell us perception requires change. Without change, we don't perceive. So there's nothing wrong with ordinary reality except that it's there all the time. It's not a criticism. And I think that one of the great values of art at its best, in great music, great painting, great literature, is that it lifts us out into another state. Which leads me to yet another spiritual challenge. And that is, how can we work on ourselves to hang on to that state longer? What can we do to keep that kind of special fire alive in ourselves between novels? Between visits to an art gallery, between CDs. By CDs, I mean the music, not the financial instrument. Even though I think it's dubious taste to quote oneself, I'm going to quote from something that I wrote in my memoir that I said to my wife, Devers, not long after hearing of Ayn Rand's death. I think it will bring into focus and sum up parts of what I've been saying. This is from the last chapter, I guess, in the epilogue of my memoir. Quote, "There's a profound need that psychology has never adequately studied, the need to experience an ecstatic state of consciousness, an experience that shatters the ordinary walls of reality and lifts a person to another plane and another level of feeling entirely. Some people seek that experience in religion and in the promise of union with God. Others seek it in sex or in passionate love affairs. Some seek it in drugs or in military battle or in music or in creative work or in an athletic performance that seems to break the bounds of the possible. Ian heard the most ecstatic music inside her head, and she never fully learned what to do with it here on earth, except through her writing. Some part of me struggled with the same problem. Not just Ian and me, but all of us. We were ecstasy addicts. No one never named it that way, but that was the key. No one can understand Ian or her appeal to people, or the force that held all of us together back in New York, who doesn't understand that there exists in human beings that need for an ecstatic state of consciousness. That's what Ian transmitted through her novels, and that's what we fell in love with and fought against leaving, because it was through her that we first entered that plane. It was a spiritual hunger, a hunger that inspired the best in us and sometimes the worst. My impression is that when people became disillusioned with Ian, they turned also against that hunger in themselves, which is a mistake. I knew that the task, after breaking with her, was to find other forms of fulfillment for that spiritual longing, not to disown and renounce it. And I have. I think that this goes to the heart of a subtle but powerful need which I believe most or all of you can find within yourselves. And I think that your reaction to her work, if it's anything like mine, is an illuminating reference point. Now, in conclusion, a few weeks ago, I was watching television, and I watched for the 1,200th time Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Anybody here like that movie beside me? Well, I think it's a fantastic movie. And it's one of the most successful movies ever made. And what fascinates me is what I think it speaks to in people. Because I don't think it's about visitors from another planet. Just to briefly remind you of the story, the Richard Dreyfuss character keeps having this weird longing. He's getting more and more dissatisfied with his life, and he keeps these drawings of something he can't understand, and finally he recognizes this as in a mountain, and he finds his way to where these people from this other planet are coming, and there's this incredible 40-minute climax where the spaceship lands, and he ends up going with the spaceship back to God knows where. And it's no matter how many times I see that movie, it is always thrilling, it always touches me, and it always touches my wife, and it always touches a great many other people. I think it's not about... It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for what? It's a metaphor for what's just what I'm talking about. It's a metaphor for that longing to break out of the ordinary, everyday experience of reality and to leap. And I think that one of the great spiritual challenges is to honor that feeling and to seek ways to integrate it in to the only life we are given that I know about, the life that we're going to be living in this lifetime and probably, at least in our lifetimes, just on this planet. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathaniel. I think we have time for a few questions if anyone would like to follow up.
Yeah. One of my favorite passages in your book, Art of Living Consciously, was where, I think I've got this right, where you said that one of the most important things that you can develop is the ability to sustain a period of non-judgmental self-observation.
Oh, yes.
And you alluded to that sort of thing. I guess this is really more psychological technique than anything else. But my question is really just opportunity to have you expand on the connection between that and spirituality.
Well, very, very simply, it's this. My point there was that when one is working on oneself, the number one priority is to be aware. And whatever else I do needs to be in the service of that end. And judgments in that context are intrusive, distracting, and subversive. It's not about that. It's about what is, and about my ability to stay in sustained contact with what is. Because while awareness is not healing, sustained awareness can be powerfully healing. And we don't want anything which gets in the way of that when there is no purpose for it. There are contexts in which judgments are relevant. They can serve a purpose, but I have to know what the purpose is and not, to use words paradoxically, not to exercise judgments mindlessly, not to exercise judgments disconnected from my purposes. I hope that's clarifying. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I hope this isn't a very obvious question, but I'm not quite sure from your lecture if objectivists are still supposed to be atheists.
Well, let's...
This is in your opinion, of course. I know what David thinks.
Well, I don't ever think in terms of what people are supposed to be, not being their mother. I am an atheist. And I know people who call themselves objectivists and who are theists, but, you know, what can I tell you? I'm an atheist, and I think that atheism is clearly objectivism is definitely an atheistic philosophy, and if now that she's deceased, if Ian has found out any information to the contrary, it has not been transmitted. All right, I cannot say more than that. Should we take maybe somebody from the second mic now?
Yes.
From the second mic.
Yes, Dr. Brandon, when you mentioned the need for ecstatic experience, the first thing that came to my mind was not how I feel when I'm in front of a piece of art or listening to a piece of art that I care very much about, although that was, I think, a close second. I thought first of those experiences I have where I'm feeling what's recently being called flow. I feel I'm in flow. Is that something that you would care to incorporate in your sense of ecstatic experience?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry for not being clear about that, so I'm very appreciative of your question. I should have certainly covered that point, and I didn't because I was too aware that I'm talking too much. But, yes, one of the great pathways to an ecstatic state of consciousness is love. I personally make it number one. I can think about three issues that I would name as number one. But I totally support what you've said. Oh, what are the other two? Well, one is art, and of course the other is when I'm at my computer and writing and everything is just going perfectly. And I'm thinking to myself, this afternoon you are a genius. Yes, sir.
Well, maybe you just answered my question. Is and the name of the conference, what should we worship?
I got to be very tactful now. All right, you give me a tremendous challenge. See, worship is not one of my favorite words. So I don't think in terms of what we should worship. I think in terms of what we should admire, but I don't think in terms of what we should worship. That is just very foreign. When I use worship, I use it as a metaphor. I'm not responsible. No one asked me what to call a conference. And I don't wish to be ungracious as a guest, so I let me off the hook, okay?
Let's take one more, and I'm afraid it's going to have to be in the back.
Thanks. I agree with everything you said about people wanting to come home and feeling a sense of a safe and an intelligible universe, but I think it was a little incomplete. How I explained, I'm an atheist also, and I think that when the major religions were started several thousand years ago, life wasn't so great, and I think that they just made up the religions just to pass the time of day, and they thought that, you know, there has to be something better than this, not just during your life, but after your life, after you die. Would you like to comment like that on that?
Well, I think you're almost certainly right. I'm sorry to be so agreeable, but I don't doubt that you're right. I didn't. Please understand me. I try to speak very precisely. I think I said one of the things that religion would be responding to would be the need that I described, implying that there were others, and that certainly. Certainly what you said has got to be true and relevant as one of the factors involved. The only thing I might question about in your language, I don't think they invented religions just to pass the time. I think something a little more urgent than that was going on.
All right, I'm afraid that's going to have to be it for our session.
This talk is copyrighted 1999 by Dr. Nathaniel Brandon and may not be copied or reproduced in any medium or form.
Thank you for making us your principal source for material on objectivism. If you are interested in investigating other matters of principle, please call us at 1-800-374-1776 or write to the address you will find on the cover of the audio binder.